Just a little bit of housekeeping. One of the speakers that was supposed to be here today from HUD is unable to, so we're certainly going to fill in, and we will do some of the discussions there. But I just wanted to go over briefly, basically, as Jim said, my role when I'm helping my clients. And, you know, occasionally we talk to folks, or you're out in the street and folks want to know what you do for a living, and I tell them, you know, I work for community associations, and they'll say, well, what's that? And I say, well, you know that Apple product you just bought? Well, I represent a company just like general counsel for Apple would, except we're on a much smaller scale. But we still have statutes that we have to deal with. We have issues we've got to deal with, codes that come down, employment issues. It's a whole range of matters that come about that we've got to deal with. And I was telling Jim earlier, I'm kind of like his Siamese twin when I'm working with him. We are somewhat joined at the hip because what I do is complement what he is trying to achieve at the request of his board. So fortunately for Jim, I get to be the guy sometimes, or if it's Karen, the woman, all right, to advise them that you're either going to be the good person or the bad person, because there's things that folks want to do that you may not be able to do. And what do I mean by that? Well, Jim talked about the governing documents and how broad they may be. And they're set up that way purposely because times change. Documents need to be fluid, as we like to explain, that you need to be able to address things 20 years from now with a document that's not so specific that you can't change them or make a decision or a rule based upon changed circumstances. But we then need to be careful when they're specific and we're dealing with clients who say, well, we're going to disregard that one. And that's one of the first things I always tell my clients is you can't pick and choose what rule or what part of the docs you want to deal with and to employ and or to enforce, because that becomes problematic. So Jim has an issue that comes up, and again, I'm talking a little bit of generalities at the moment. We will certainly get into some specifics. But then my job is to try and help him formulate a policy that the board wants to implement so that it's in a proper place or in a proper form that it now can be enforced. Let's call it a resolution, since that's what we're talking about, rules and regs and resolutions. I need to then go through the docs and make a decision based upon what they want to implement. What can I do and how can I implement it in writing? But I then have to look at outside sources. I have to make a determination, is there a statute that deals with it? And we'll be talking about housing discrimination in a moment, or in a few moments. And as a result of that, bring those outside sources in and try and write a policy for Jim that he can then present to our respective client for adoption. Now, one of the little pet peeves of mine, and this is just coming from me, you can certainly talk to your own counsel, I never record a resolution, ever. Never, ever. And the reason being is, A, it's not required. And two, think about things today. You've got a board right now that's situated. You have a manager right now that's situated. 20 years from now, that board's not going to be here. 20 years, probably, the management company's not going to be here. And you're going to probably have different counsel. Unless you are 100% certain that you're going to keep your books in order, and I'll challenge anybody to come before me and say that you're going to be 100% certain that your books are always going to be indisputable, you're going to run into a problem. We learned this the hard way many years ago, where we had a board that wanted us to put a new resolution together. You know, I was young, it's when the hair was not as blonde as it is today, and put something together. It wasn't anything major, but it had turned out that years before that they had recorded a resolution. So that which they wanted to now adopt ran counter to what was already on the books. So it's a problem you run into if you're going to start recording resolutions. Some folks want to do it for certain reasons. I'm just going to caution that you should not, because you run into an issue, okay, in that regard. So we got a resolution in play, and then we're going to have to start putting it into actual adoption and or enforcement. Well, that's where it also becomes sticky sometimes, and that's where Karen's going to chat a little bit about it, is you should do your best to put a resolution together to deal with a policy that the board wants to implement, but then you need to make sure that you're going to enforce it as you've either written it or as the law requires you to do it. Just because you now have a resolution in play doesn't mean you're fair game, or it's fair game just to now determine how you're going to enforce it. Because once we start enforcing, that's where the problems start cropping up, and that's when we then turn to Karen to help get us out of a sticky situation. So I'm just going to turn it over for a moment to Karen, just in terms of her role, because once it goes from Jim to me to Karen, Jim and I are still involved in the matter. We have to be, because of Karen's relationship with the other two. So it was kind of a good little sequence to let Jim go first, and then what my general role is as counsel And then when Karen comes in, to bail us both out.
Perhaps. Can everybody in the back hear okay?
No.
You cannot? All right, you know what? I'll go over here and see if this microphone is better.
Or I'll try to move it.
Normally, I'm accused of having a very loud voice, so I normally have to temper it. So today I'll do it the opposite way. As Chris and Jim were saying, normally my firm would come in as defense counsel. You've got a problem. Your rule and regulation is already in place or should be in place and is not. You may have someone in the community, someone who has made a request. For whatever reasons, that request has not met with the person's satisfaction. It could be, I need a closer parking space where you don't have enough parking spaces to begin with, or maybe you do, and for some reason it fell through the cracks. Now you may have a claim with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. It could be somebody doesn't like the smells that are coming through the common elements, the HVAC. Is that really discrimination? You'd be surprised. I've seen a lot of these claims, just had one recently this winter where there was an issue with odors. There's an issue with smoke. There's been issues with, I don't like the spices you're using. And then if the people start to complain, the person who's using the spices may have a national origin claim, which means a claim for discrimination. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know at this point. Some of the other issues we've seen, and probably what you've seen also, has to do with service animals or emotional support animals. I used to think they were one and the same. Luckily, I started reading more, was exposed to more of the opinions of HUD, some more case laws, some more conciliations, and found out that there can be the need for a service animal or there can be a need for an emotional support animal. However, a person is not necessarily entitled to both a service animal and an emotional support animal. And I think Jim and Chris will go through that a bit more in terms of maybe some requests you've seen or some issues you've had in your associations with what's allowed and what's not allowed. Suppose you have a no pet policy. Are you saying now we have to let in dogs? Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes you do. We have up here a PowerPoint presentation that none of us can take credit for. The gentleman from the Department of Housing and Urban Development was going to present this for us. Unfortunately, as Chris said, due to a lack of funding, he's not able to join us today. So we will miss him participating. I'm sure you came to see him also. One of the things we need to look at under the guidelines, and we have two sets of guidelines. We have the federal guidelines, the Federal Fair Housing Act, and we also have the New Jersey Law Against Discrimination. For my intent and purposes, when I'm defending an association, defending management, sometimes, forgive me, defending general counsel, or defending individual unpaid volunteers, the only ones who don't get paid in this equation, one of the things that happens is that we need to get information from everyone. It's almost going back to the beginning again. Jim just stood here and told you, I need to have the reasons, I need to have the basis for why we're putting together rules and regulations. I need to make sure it comports with the law, which is where Chris comes in. When I come into the scene, my job is to drive everyone crazy, to look under rocks, to make people hunt down emails, to go through those files. What, you just transitioned between management companies? You have 20 boxes of documents that haven't been organized yet? Sorry, guys, tough luck. Because I'm gonna need every single piece of paper, communication, ounce of information that may help you as an association or whoever else is involved in your equation defend this situation. Just for my curiosity, how many people are board members out in the audience? Okay, the large majority. How about managers? All right, you're almost neck and neck. Do I dare point out the attorneys? All right, we'll let you keep your hands up.
Yeah,
the crowd doesn't go after you. But when I come into the scene, we're already dealing with either the Department of Housing and Urban Development on the federal level, which normally comes out of New York or comes out of their Newark office in New Jersey. I don't always see too much out of Trenton. It depends how the staffing and the funding is, to be frank with you. Or we're dealing with somebody from the state of New Jersey, the Division of Civil Rights. Perhaps HUD on the federal level has already passed on the claim or the complaint to our state level. Doesn't always make sense to me why it happens, why it doesn't sometimes, but thankfully it's not part of this presentation today. But what happens is we're already going to be involved with the government. We're going to get a complaint. Technically, a claim has to be filed within 180 days of the claim of discrimination. The complaint may be filed a week after that. It depends how long it takes from an administrative process. But let's say, for instance, Jim's Ford has come up with a policy, no pets whatsoever. There's a woman who's living at that association, has been living there for 10 years, has had a cat. Nobody was ever really aware of it, but recently she decided she was going to start walking her cat outside on the beach. Okay? A little bizarre, but now everybody's aware of it. They say to Jim, we have a no pet policy. That means cats. How are you letting her get away with this? Jim goes to Chris and says, all right, well, I guess I can enforce this, right? I can send a violation notice to her. Now, Chris, what would you say in that situation?
Well, the manager's going to come out and they're... Can everybody hear me or you want me to stand? The manager's going to say, we have this policy. It's going to be strictly enforced. We do not allow any pets. But you got to, I think, go with what you've got in terms of your policy until you get that letter back that advises them, I need this cat for the following reasons. All right, so once you're trying to enforce your policy, when you get that letter back that now triggers some additional questions that now must be asked, you're not just going to be able to then go ahead and say, well, now we're going to enforce our finding. You're going to have to sit back and, as you indicated, get me every ounce of paper that, you know, deals with these particular issues before we move forward.
And one of the things that we would be looking at is the timing from the association. Before an association, I'm just going to use that. It does incorporate managers as players, board members, but for sake of a shortcut, I'm going to refer to the association. When the association has a claim against it, one of the first things I'm going to look at, aside from the timing, are they within their rights? Have they timely filed in terms of the board denied them the right to have this cat? Did they file their claim within 180 days of that denial of the association, which the government may call violation down the road? That 180 days can be a little bit tricky because you may have something that's called a continuing violation. Next thing you know, we've got violations coming in from 365 days ago, 560 days ago. But again, that's a topic for another day, not something you need to worry about right now. That's what the lawyers need to worry about. But long story made short, what I'm going to look at is the same thing that Jim and Chris and you as a board are going to be looking at if somebody asks for an exception to rules and regulations or what you may perceive to be an exception to the no pet policy. I'm going to ask, is there a disability? The question then becomes, how do we know? How do we know for sure? Is somebody just saying, oh, I've got an allergy when it comes to pesticides? Are they saying, well, I don't feel good this week. I didn't have a great Christmas. I didn't get the presents I wanted. So now I need a kitten. I went out and bought a kitten for myself. That's not going to rise to the level of an emotional support animal or to a disability. Under both the federal guidelines and the state guidelines, the handicap is set forth. There are definitions. And I will tell you, it's getting broader and broader. I would say every year. Would you agree?
I would.
New Jersey, actually, is broader than the federal guidelines. So if you've got a claim that's arising in New Jersey, I would happen to say, and I'm looking at Martin Corvina, one of the attorneys who I didn't make raise his hand, but I think he would agree, I would happen to say there's not too much that's not going to fall within that. Now, claims for discrimination, after you find out whether somebody has a disability, one thing your general counsel may do is they may request that the person requesting what I sometimes call an exception to the rules and regulations provide you with medical information. Chris, have you used any particular forms or documents when you receive a request?
No, we don't, but and you have to be careful because you can't be so intrusive as to the issue that it now borders on, you know, HIPAA violations if the doctor were to give that. But, you know, we also then run into certain problems, as you've probably all seen, is you get almost on a prescription-type form a little note from the doctor that indicates that they've got, you know, an issue without going into specifics as to why this particular person may need a service animal. So you got to really balance in terms of how intrusive are we going to be versus how upfront do we think the doctor is based upon the writing we get back as to whether or not this person truly has a legitimate issue, that they can then have a legitimate animal. So the issue really before us all is, you know, when that letter goes out and the moment you get a letter back or a call back from the homeowner that says, I've got a problem that requires me to have this, you need to step back and go to counsel so that they can assist you in trying to give you the game plan moving forward for the additional information that you must have so that we don't have a claim with Karen.
Yeah. I want to jump in on this a little bit because I think that what you should hopefully glean out of a lot of the conversation today is that it's really important to research the topic before you have the usual emotional response or the typical emotional response or reaction to the request, because the area of service animals and comfort animals is fortunately pretty well specified. So you can't just say, well, Fluffy is my cat and that's my comfort animal. There's certain criteria that those animals, I think, have to have about them. And certainly a service animal is pretty well spelled out and referred to as a dog that's had training. It can't just be your favorite beagle that you've had for 15 years. It needs to be a dog that's actually been trained. So I think that if you look behind some of these emotional topics before you react as a community or as a board, it may be easier for you to react because you have some real facts that are then going to help you tell this resident that unfortunately they have to remove the animal from the house or adhere to your no pet policy after all. And it really takes a little bit of that onus off of you and the emotion off of you as being the bad guy, because you really aren't the bad guy in that particular situation. So as far as comfort animals, I mean, what's the scope of comfort animals? Because that seems to be a broader topic than, or a broader area than service animals.
Well, even with comfort animals, you have to be careful because There is statistics out there or scientific evidence that, you know, Fluffy can possibly decrease the amount of blood pressure that's going through your body. You know, and somebody could come up and that's a reason. That's why, and Karen asked a question, I didn't answer it, and I apologize, is we don't have a form when a person comes forward saying that they need a service or comfort animal, because each matter takes on its own life. Right? And it all depends in terms of where you're going to be a year from now based upon the inquiry that the association made. Right, with the answers given and then how you reacted to it. So it's very hard to say, you know, answer one, if you answered yes to one, go to 1A. You need to make a due diligence inquiry. So even comfort animals to a certain extent could have applicability under the law if it can be shown that there's a rational reason they need this, such as high blood pressure, this animal brings the blood pressure down. So you've got to be careful.
But my snake might help me, but my snake scares everybody else in the building around me. So
right. I don't know any cases about snakes yet, but I would agree with you in that regard.
Okay. So there are some limitations. Okay.
I'm looking at Terry.
There is a snake case, actually. There was a unit owner in another state he was keeping snakes. He had 3 or 4 acre snakes. And the association, you know, has a rule that only dogs and cats. And so they wrote him and they told him, you know, that he had to get rid of the snakes. And he said, you know, I need these snakes for my well-being or whatever. And the association
Plus, he was probably selling handbags out of the unit, too, right?
I'm just going to hold questions to the end, if you don't mind. Sorry, I apologize. Ms. Kessler's our moderator, so we're going to make her jump in from time to time. I'm glad you brought up the snakes and that you knew something about it. I personally haven't had a snake case. One of the things I was going to say is, when we're thinking about the type of defenses we may have when we're presented with discrimination claims, the snake analogy actually brings up a good one, because you don't necessarily have to make a certain type of accommodation if there could be a safety issue, an endangerment issue, a health issue. And I'm sorry, if I was living next door to those snakes, it's either the snakes or me. One of us is going. So I would venture to guess that you may be able to get a court to see that there could be a potential safety issue. Most of the time I hear about snakes, whether it's in the newspaper or on TV, they've escaped. Somebody who has brought in these beautiful, great snakes I would never touch in a million years has somehow lost track of them. And that's what I would be afraid of, and that's what I'd be arguing to the court. And that is one of the problems you look at when you're trying to determine what's a reasonable accommodation. You have to determine it on the threshold level, on the ground floor level. When I come back later on, I'm just trying to find ways to help you out so you don't get slapped with a fine, a penalty, damages. You can get damages for emotional distress in these cases. Most of the cases, we attorneys are a little bit smug. Oh, you've never gone to a doctor. You haven't gone to a psychiatrist. You can't recover emotional distress damages. Ha ha, you don't have to keep getting treatment from a doctor or a psychiatrist in discrimination cases to potentially be awarded claims for emotional distress, embarrassment, humiliation, indignity, inconvenience, and then we have economic loss, real damages, legal fees, costs, and then, of course, we do have violations, which we'll touch on before this seminar ends.
Karen, let me just interject thing that I wanted to say earlier. For the boards and the managers out there, you also have to understand what, you know, in Karen's role and when she's assigned, you want to make sure that you've done everything you're supposed to, not only under your governing documents, but you also have to make sure you have at least a semblance of an understanding of what your insurance policy says. Because your insurance policy is a contract, and that contract sets forth the conditions by which you will have coverage and what you must do in order to have coverage afforded to you. One of the biggest mistakes that we see out there, and Jim and Karen can yes or no, is untimely notice. Now, your contract may say when you need to give notice, but we've become very conservative over the years that the moment that there's not necessarily the term attorney, litigate, money, costs,
I'll
but it smells like it's coming. You need to make certain you put your carrier through your broker on notice for no other reason than just to say something may be coming down the pike. Because I can guarantee you, and I bet it would be less than five people, that you've read your insurance policies from beginning to end and know exactly what they say. So that's what we always tell clients when Jim calls me and says, we have this issue. I need to find out more about it, and then I've got to make sure that you give notice. The other issue is when Karen's working a case, at some point, the insurance company may make a decision that it makes sense, both from strategy and economics, to offer a settlement to the person who's suing for the emotional distress. And the board's got to then make a decision, because you're either going to say, we agree, or we disagree. Now, if you disagree, the company may come back and say, okay, that lifeline that we just gave you, it's gone. You're on your own. You're going to take this to trial. We're not going to provide any more coverage in terms of costs, and or possibly if you lose, you know, the monies that we would have ponied up aren't going to be there anymore. That's the other reason you need to make certain that you've got great documentation, as Karen indicated earlier, that she wants to see everything, because then it comes back onto my lap to help make a determination. Should we really take this to trial, or should we take the deal that the insurance carrier is telling us that we should take?
Okay, so let's change topics for a minute and get into another one that may be more frequent in your communities, and that's the topic of handicapped parking. That can initially be a pretty easy topic to evaluate in terms of what's the association's requirement. What provisions has the association already have in place for handicap needs within the community? But what I have found, you know, is that the handicap parking is typically not enough, or it's not convenient to the newer people who are now asking for the handicap parking in a different part of the parking area, or typically, as is expected, they would want it closer to their entrance, or they would want it in an area where it's more well lit or whatever. And typically the developers in the communities have put, you know, two parking spaces or maybe three if you really got lucky. But those are always full. So now, you know, your building or your community in the clubhouse area or whatever has had a need for or an outcry of people that are looking for more handicapped parking for various reasons. And you need you want to evaluate that. You want to make an analysis of the need for that and how to accommodate those people. So how do I go about that, Chris? I mean, where am I going to put that where it's going to be convenient for the person requesting it? But the other part of that is that, you know, it's not going to be in front of their building, perhaps. It's going to have to be down at the other end of the parking, because now I have to make a larger parking space to accommodate potentially a wheelchair, and now I've got to restripe a whole section of parking. So, you know, although I'm trying to accommodate them by adding another parking space, it may not be convenient for them. And how do I juggle that?
Well, we all know that federal law requires that we have to make the reasonable accommodation. Okay, but we have to make it based upon the parameters by which, you know, this particular association is infrastructured. So we're not going to be required to necessarily rip out, you know, additional landscaping to assist this person. So if the best that we can do, and again, you have to deal with the issue, and folks, it's sometimes hard to look in the mirror, but we're dealing with folks who are making a request who aren't necessarily totally honest. Okay, so it's difficult to prove a negative if I can't get additional good proof that these folks really aren't what they claim to be. We may have agendas within the association why they don't want to help this particular person, so I've got to try and overcome that sometime. But I always try and tell the client that, yes, we have to make this accommodation, but I'm not required to get them the closest spot if it's going to cause a hardship for the association or other people who may be in similar straits. So it's, again, another one of those issues where I've got to gather as much information as I can so that I can assist you and the board in making a decision where best to put this person. But you never can tell what's in a person's heart, and that's where we start running into problems.
Right. Well, I mean, my board's talked about it a couple of times, and they're willing to look at it and willing to evaluate it, but they're really set on requiring the person to pay for the signs and pay for the striping and all that. And is that reasonable, or is that going to be deemed as being unreasonable, Karen?
It can cut either way. It really can. One of the things that happens when we see the handicapped parking, as both Jim and Chris have said, everything's going to be a fact-by-fact basis, case-by-case basis, to your particular association. Are you really doing all you can do? Are you doing it timely? Are you doing it in a nice manner? Because one of your defenses at the end of the day was, did you have a timely, interactive process with the complainant? Say, for instance, somebody makes a request of Jim. You know, I need a different spot. Can you have the person in spot 1A moved? And Jim says, well, yes, I'll put it on the agenda for our next board meeting. That's beautiful. That's what I'd like to see. Because later on, if there's a complaint, now I'm already showing straight out the gate that the manager is acting in a reasonable fashion. Suppose instead Jim had said, oh man, you know, I know the board president's really mad at this guy, hasn't paid his maintenance fees. Somebody saw him walking a dog, he didn't pick up after his dog, and the president says, oh, we have too much to do at the next board meeting. Let's put it off to the next one. Conveniently, the next one's not for another 3 months. We've got a problem. And HUD and the investigators down the road are going to see there's a problem also. So again, hate to sound redundant, the stuff I look for to defend the association or to figure out if you better settle quickly is the same stuff that Jim and then Chris and yourselves as board members are going to be working on at the beginning of the day.
So my experience has been, and maybe I've just been fortunate, but my experience has been in some cases where we've had to make, we've been asked to make an accommodation to allow for the installation of a ramp or the installation of signs. And in the cases where we have asked the homeowner to participate in some of that expense, or we've asked the resident to participate in, you know, okay, we'll allow you to put the ramp in now to the front of the building, but when you leave, you need to take it down, or when your disability clears itself, you know, you need to be responsible. And you know, it's been a shared relationship or a shared experience. It's been pretty successful. I mean, I don't know. I haven't had, fortunately, anybody really press it hard and have the association get into a litigation situation. I don't know what your experience is.
Well, thank you for politely bringing me back to your original question I didn't answer. Who has to pay? Most of the time, under the guidelines, the person who's making the request for the reasonable accommodation can't be refused to make the reasonable accommodation or modification at that person's expense. Let's not talk about new communities or, all right, I see a knit in your brows, but I'll give some examples. Let's not talk about barrier-free subcode issues. Let's not talk about ADA issues for new construction or rehabilitative construction. We're talking about just minor issues. Most of the time, the owner should be the one making those calls. However, Jim, and maybe Chris, you might differ with me, sometimes if it's as small as putting up a $25 sign, you're going to resolve the issue, you're going to move on, you're going to save on attorney's fees for that $25 fine. I would agree. I would counsel the association, you know, it could be, put up the sign. You know what, there's probably going to be somebody else that's going to need to use it anyway.
Can I
answer it?
Yes, thank you.
And I do agree with that. Generally, the member who wants the accommodation will pay for it. We are about 15 minutes away. I want to go through another subject so that we can then open it up for questions. Let's go to this forced age discrimination. Let's talk about the issue, and we'll get to the questions in a moment, sir. Let's talk about the 55 and older developments for a moment, particularly in those cases.
Excuse me. It's 55 and better?
Proper term. 55 and better. I apologize.
Excellent.
Okay, you with me out there? Okay, all right.
Excellent.
I'll realize that in 4 years. The issue that we're starting to see more of because of these economic constraints are children coming home, but more importantly, children coming home with their children. All right, when it's clearly defined that, you know, we'll accept a 19-year-old for a length of time, but nobody under that. How best to deal with those issues? I'm not going to get into a great discussion about the law, because at some point, you are able, because of the way that the federal law is structured, to legally discriminate. But if you do not do that and you don't follow your rules, at some point, you may lose the right to enforce them. And I can't tell you today, is it one time, two times? It's very fact sensitive, but I can tell you at some point, you will lose if you don't have the ability or you do not enforce your ability to discriminate. Here's what I typically do under those situations, because it's happened a number of times. We have given folks, because of times, in both cases that I dealt with, a year to have that child put somewhere else. Now, we're not asking the owner's children to move because it's their grandchild and their children, but basically to give that family an opportunity to either A, get on their feet, find another place to live, but after 365 days, we will go to court to seek an order for you to be removed. Not that we're happy about it, but I've got a development of 1,000, I've got one home that's affected, and I have 999 other folks, including the parents who really don't want their child back anyway, who also would agree, that we moved here because we don't want children here of small age. So it's a very emotional issue, and we understand that, but we're trying to find some solutions to give the time. I think a year is typically okay. I don't know of any cases that have told me that a year is not, particularly if the child's in school. In both cases, we found out because of the school buses coming to pick them up.
Huh.
But you really need to look at them and not come down so hard, because then all of a sudden, and I'm going to give it to Karen, we're now dealing with Karen, because we came down so hard that we didn't have a good fact pattern that if I had to enforce it, that I'd be able to.
Yeah, I agree with Chris. Chris is telling me this is a better mic. I think I'm too much. I'll go with it. I agree with Chris, and I haven't had personal experience to date with either a federal complaint or a state-level complaint having to do with this kind of discrimination. I have seen early notice claims, what Chris was talking about, because people are starting to learn how to report to the insurance carrier earlier and earlier. So I may be contacted by a carrier and they may say to me, you know, what do you think about this situation? Do you think that this is going to arise to a complaint or to a discrimination? Is there exposure, et cetera? I think the year is very decent, is very reasonable. What I question is, have you seen any negativity, any feedback from neighbors that say you don't have the right to give this person a year to accommodate this family situation?
Fortunately, in these situations, we didn't. Those who had an interest in it, particularly those living near them, they were all brought in and explained the circumstances, so they understood what the board was trying to achieve, and they bought in, which was important in this case.
Just real quick, I know we're running out of time very quickly here today. What I do see, though, in terms of the 55 and better communities, and I think you should coin that phrase, I like it very much, I see more complaints that can arise to discrimination coming out of a disability perspective when there are issues with home health aid workers. You may have different people coming around the clock. There may be residents in your community that really truly require 24-hour care. That 24-hour care may be divided into three shifts. The neighbors around you are starting to get a little bit affected. You may have a change in personnel. Not that the resident with the disability wants that, but it happens. You have people with oversized vans, oversized trucks parking. Maybe they're parking in the wrong place. They've started to bring their children with them or grandchildren as they're watching the owner or the resident. They're now starting to take walks along the golf course, not just them and the resident, perhaps in the wheelchair, but now they have an entourage or the resident's not even with them. They're back home. And the home health aid worker, or just the kids by themselves, are walking around. What do you do? How do you balance the interests of the community? What do you do for the neighbors that are being affected? What do you do for the fact that you need to enforce your rules and regulations, that the common elements, i.e. the golf course paths, are only for the use of the owners and their guests? Is a home health aid worker truly a guest? Most people would say no. So I'm seeing issues from that perspective where if the association goes to take action and tries to enforce the parking or tries to enforce other type of restrictions revolving around the medical personnel or home health aid workers, the owner or the family on behalf of the owner, which is allowed depending upon the level of disability, is starting to say we're being discriminated against. We're not able to use our home or live our life in the quality that we should. Not a preferential quality, but as close to equal as other people. So those are the ones I'm seeing more and more.